Tony Short from the University of Cambridge, and he's going to be telling us about generalized entropies, information causality, and non-local gains. So, over to you, Tony.
Thanks. Quick, as you can see. Oh, wow. Okay. Now you can hear me. Sorry, I'll try and quiet down a bit. Okay, that's a bit scary actually. So the idea behind this work is that to try and apply the ideas that we use in when we apply entropies to information processing problems, to try and lift some of those concepts and some of those tools over to the general probabilistic framework. And the hope would be a lot of advantage in doing this. And in particular, this is kind of motivated by this information causality result, which is a very entropic result, so this sort of motivated a lot of the people to start thinking about entropies in general probabilistic theories. And then at the end, we're going to sort of drift slightly from information causality onto something related to non-local gains. So hopefully it'll all sort of make sense as we go through, but the final end point is a slightly different finish point from the beginning. So this is joint work. So most of the earlier stuff is joint work with Stephanie Weiner, who's here. And a few things near the end, a joint work with my student, Sabri Al-Safi. Okay, so I think I've given the sort of basic outline, but the key idea here is that we all know from going through the quantum information community that entropies are hugely useful things, and you can prove all sorts of exciting theorems with them, and you can analyze quantitatively information processing problems, and, I mean, they've been hugely useful all the way through quantum information. So it's a sort of natural idea to try and bring these things into general probabilistic frameworks. And in fact, it was such a natural idea that pretty much three groups had the idea at the same time. And there were three papers that went on the archive completely independently. The work was completely independent, but we did find out that someone else was working it. And so we did synchronize ourselves. That was me and Stephanie and then this huge list of authors, most of whom are here actually, who we sort of found out we were working on similar things, and we decided to coordinate. And then almost immediately afterwards, Jen Kimura and his group put something else on as well, which they'd been working on. And the amazing thing is that even though all of the work in these was completely independent, there's an incredible amount of overlap. I mean, in terms of the things we all define, we made the same choices in lots of different places. I mean, of course, there are different results as well, but it's it really was obviously something that was in the air at the time. So I'm going to obviously focus on our results, but there's lots of other interesting results in these other papers, which I think I won't have time to say everything about, but I'm just going to, mainly focus on our sort of perspective. Okay, so by now you've heard a lot about these general probabilistic frameworks and general operational models. I'm going to give you a quick recap, but I don't want to spend too long on it because there have been lots of talks already on it. One thing to note, a sort of flag, is that our aim here was to be a little bit more general than some of the things we've seen. So we wanted to keep, to not make a couple of simplifying assumptions that people often make. One is that often it is assumed that all mathematically well-defined measurements are physically achievable, and we wanted to not assume that, so we can have restricted sets of measurements if we want. And we also wanted slightly more interesting, perhaps, because there seems to be very little work not assuming local tomography, but we tried to do that and not assume local tomography, so our results should, in principle, apply to real quantum theory, which is, of course, an interesting theory, but it doesn't have local tomography. So our aim was to keep a bit open, and that's perhaps something that differentiates slightly from some of the other papers. Okay, so just to recap some of the operational framework, I'm not going to go through everything because that will be a talk in itself, but I just wanted to get you our notation. So obviously there are sort of different types of system in the world, so the idea here is to be as general and operational as possible so that you rule out as little as possible. So we think there are systems in the world, and those systems have states, and a state here is really just anything that's sufficient to predict the probabilities of all measurements. And we also allow ourselves to believe that we can do mixtures, prepare mixtures of states. And so we introduce these objects which are mixed states, and then we demand that they're allowed states if the other, if the components are allowed. And so these state sets are sort of convex sets. And then, so this is a sort of standard thing. We sort of assume that if we have two separate systems, we can prepare them independently. In, if we have system A prepared in some state SA and system B prepared in some state SB, then that is a well-defined state of the whole. Now this is, so I'm going to use the tensor product to indicate that this is the state which we got by independently preparing SA and SB. But because we don't assume local tomography, this is not necessarily going to, and in fact, you know, in some cases won't be the tensor product on a real vector space. And so if you have local tomography, then you can really understand this as an actual tensor product in a real vector space. You can have each system in its own space, and then the joint system lives in the tensor product. But we're just going to use this to mean, okay, we know that we've prepared these things independently, and they better obey all our intuitions about what that means. And this better be a unique, well-defined state. And we're going to call these things product states, and then, of course, we can just expand our vocabulary and say that mixtures of these things are separable, and anything that's not a mixture of these things is entangled. So we want to talk a bit about measurements. So we're going to use E's for measurements, which is, of course, carries over from this use of effects. So it's also a bit strange to see measurements not be N's, but it seems to be quite common rather than the E's. So a measurement is, the measurement as a whole, we're going to have be some bold E. And then this measurement has a finite set of outcomes. And for each of those outcomes, we associate an effect, which is going to be a non-bold E. I think it'll probably be clear from context, so it's not clear on the slide. And an effect is just, basically, it's the thing you do to the state to work out what the probability of that outcome was. And so it's got to be a map from states to the real numbers, and in particular, because it's supposed to be a probability in the end, it's got to be bigger than 0 and smaller than 1. And the other thing we demand is that it's affine, which just means that if you act on a mixed state, it does what you'd intuitively expect. So if you prepare, you know, with probability P1, you prepare S1, and with probability P2, you prepare S2, and then you do a measurement, you better get the results such that, you know, the probabilities just move through the measurement results, so your chance of getting the result is just P times the probability of getting the result if you prepared S1, plus 1 minus P times the probability of getting the result if you prepared S2. So this is all very standard. And then, of course, the other constraint for a measurement is if you look at all the outcomes, you better get 1 total probability 1. So that just says that if you sum all the effects in a measurement, then you get what we're going to call the unit effect, which just gives you 1 for all allowed states. So we're not going to need to use unnormalized states here, so states are going to be normalized. And then, in the same way as we talked about independent states, we clearly have a notion which we're going to put straight into our operational framework that if we have separate systems, we can measure them separately. And if this is an allowed measurement on this system, and this is an allowed measurement on this system, then there's something which is just doing both those allowed measurements. And that better be a well-defined thing in the framework, and we're going to use this symbol again to represent it. And then on top of all this, there's a lot of consistency constraints which sort of just shore up all these intuitive concepts. So it better be that if we do the product measurement on the product state, we get the product of the probabilities for the outcomes. Okay, so that's all pretty standard, and it should apply to any reasonable theory you would care to talk about in a sort of operational way. But we're going to introduce a bit of a sort of more detailed terminology. So it's going to be important to talk about whether measurements are fine-grained or not. So we're going to have a notion of a refinement of a measurement. So this is just basically means, so a measurement is, one measurement is the refinement of another if it provides strictly more information. So you can always recreate the original results, but you could sometimes get some extra bit of information. So the way to do this really is just to decompose. So if this is the original effect and this is the refinement, what we've done is we've split up one effect here into two effects here, which are non-parallel. So there's a sort of trivial refinement, which is just, you know, taking lambda times the effect and then a separate effect, which is 1 minus lambda times the effect. But that doesn't ever give you any more information, and in fact, it just corresponds to doing the original measurement and then tossing a coin to announce a result in each case. So we're going to sort of not consider these trivial refinements and say that for it to count as a proper refinement, it better be that you've got sort of, you've really split this thing up into two non-identical bits. And then we're going to need this set of fine-grained measurements, E star. And we're going to make an assumption that there is at least one fine-grained measurement you could do on your system. I mean, you could sort of, in principle, you could imagine some infinite hierarchy of increasingly complicated measurements which never really terminate at something fine-grained, but for the purposes of this talk, we're going to make this quite reasonable-sounding assumption that there's at least one fine-grained thing you can do. So on a quantum state, a fine-grained measurement is just a rank 1 PAVM. All the PAVM elements are rank 1, and that's fine-grained. So obviously there's a sort of converse of that. If you lump results together and sort of forget which one you got, then that's coarse-graining. And we're going to always assume that, I mean, because we're trying to be operational here, it seems like that's always something you could do in the lab, so it better be that our allowed set of measurements is closed under that kind of thing. I mean, if someone tried to tell me I'm not allowed to look at this measurement and sort of forget part of the result, that seems a bit odd. So we're always going to operationally allow coarse-graining. And this means that the unit measurement is actually always a measurement in our measurement set, because taking our one fine-grained measurement that exists and then coarse-graining it, we must get the unit measurement. So that's really so that's fine-grainedness and refinements. And then just to sort of flag that sometimes, kind of as everyone does, when I'm talking about the entropy of some state later on, I might just drop the S because it just gets in everyone's way. So if you see this, don't worry too much. It's just, well, as it always is, just the entropy of some state on an A system and a B system. Okay, so that's all I want to say really about the framework. I'll say there's quite a lot. I mean, I've mainly been introducing the words here. There's quite a lot of consistency conditions you need to make sure that these things behave according to your intuitions. But you know, if you're interested in that detail, then certainly there are many places you could find that, and our paper's one. But I think this is enough to get to understand the talk, so I'm going to plow on. Okay, so just so we haven't actually assumed that any really way about how these things are represented, so we can mix and match a little bit. So we could, if we want to represent classical probability theory by having states be finite probability vectors and effects be just affine maps on those. But in quantum theory, if we want to, we can still have, there's nothing really stopping us in what I've previously said, just using the usual quantum representation. We could have trace one positive operators as our states, and then we could have effects be the Born rule. And that, certainly all the words I introduced previously make sense for that model. And as I said, fine-grained measurements here are PAVMs with rank one elements. But one of the nice things that maybe is a future interesting question is, in principle, if we restrict the set of quantum states and measurements, then there are some things you can't do in the lab. And because entropy is somehow encapsulating information about what you can operationally do, it wouldn't be crazy if the natural entropy in those situations changed. It was no longer the von Neumann entropy, but now some different entropy, which took account of the fact that there are some things you just can't do. I mean, in particular, of course, when you restrict to just classical states and classical measurements, then you'd want the entropy to change over to the Shannon entropy. I mean, of course, that all sort of follows, but you can imagine that there's more subtle things that would happen if you only include PAVMs with more than the dimension amount of elements. So you can't do a measurement that's the same rank as the space. That might introduce weird things into your entropic arguments. I mean, like, you would no longer be able to have perfectly distinguishable states in a d-dimensional space because you've got no d-outcome measurements to do them with. So I think the ability to include these cases might be interesting, even if we want to just think about quantum theory, even if we're not interested in other theories. And, of course, as I say, we had this motivation to try and keep ourselves open to real quantum theory as we went along, which is an interesting kind of theory as well. And then there's one other sort of special case, which has received a fair amount of attention. So if we look at the general probabilistic theories, I think it's sort of high time we had another good toy model to fit in our set, but a toy model that's been well studied is Boxworld. I'm kind of quite pleased that it's been called Boxworld now officially in papers, so I think it's a bit more manageable than this generalized non-signaling theory that John introduced a while ago. And I think we were influential in getting Boxworld into print, so that's good. Okay, so now there's something kind of quite subtle here. So the problem with these boxes is they turn up in two different contexts. They often turn up as real black boxes that you have in your lab, where the input is your measurement setting and the output is your result, and you imagine you actually have in front of you essentially a box. But this is what we're going to talk about here, although it uses basically the same language, is different. Here, we're just going to talk about some convex set of states, and those states are non-signaling probability distributions. So when I see a box, all I know is it's a primitive system in some theory. I mean, it could be like an electron or a positron in this thing. It's just some little system that's a basic system in my theory. Because these system states are characterized by these probability distributions of outputs given inputs, there's a sort of natural feeling that these things are sort of processing boxes. You put in a measurement choice and you get out a measurement result. But although this is a good sort of basic intuition, you've always got to keep in your mind that you're trying to talk about the physics of a complete world here. You're not really talking about... you're really believing you are in box world and there's nothing but boxes. You know, the boxes are the primitive systems of this world. As of yet, all you know is the states of these abstract objects. You don't really know yet that there is a measurement which corresponds to putting the X in and getting the A out. We've just defined the states here, and they're these probability distributions, and they obey non-signaling. So I'm sure this is something that's come up a lot. So they obey this relation that says that basically, if you sum over one party's outputs, then everybody else is independent of their input. And actually, this is sufficient to... You might think there's more complicated signaling conditions where B and C get together to signal to A or something complicated, but these are actually enough to generate all of those. So you only need to consider this one to the rest signaling, and the rest is covered, at least in terms of these actual box inputs. But then you may have thought that it would go wrong again when you open yourself up to new measurements, but it still doesn't. It still works. So one famous state now in this theory is the state of two little boxes which have two inputs and two outputs, which is the PR box state, which is characterized by this probability distribution, which you've all seen a lot. So it gives A and B are maximally random here, and the sum of A and B mod 2 is equal to the product of X and Y. Okay, so this is where it gets a bit interesting. So in Boxworld, as defined originally and as has been carried on through, what you actually do is you allow all mathematically well-defined states and measurements and transformations. So these are the states, and then any affine map from those distributions to the 0-1 interval is a valid measurement. Now, it is true that some of those maps correspond to put the X in the box and get an A out the bottom, and then the measured result is A. So that it at least covers, you know, at least connects up to this original pitch you had of a box with an input and output. But there certainly could be other things you could do. Now, it turns out, after quite a complicated proof, that if you just have two systems of any size, then all you can do is essentially use them like they were boxes. There are no joint measurements on two boxes in Boxworld, which are like the Bell measurement. But that's not, we didn't put that in by hand, that's a theorem. So you can do things like, you know, do this measurement on this system, and then depending on the result, do some measurement on the other system. These are all, of course, allowed. But, yeah, there's nothing like a Bell measurement here, or indeed anything that's not doable with sort of wires. But although this made us kind of quite, so this was something that me and John worked on a while ago, and although this made us quite confident when it worked for 2 that it would work for any number. This 3 much bigger than 2 problem came in again, and it turned out that for 3 boxes, there is something you can do in the theory, in box world, that doesn't have a representation in terms of wirings. So there's some global joint measurement you can do, which you couldn't do by just putting things in the boxes, transferring them across, putting them in other boxes, etc. So in particular, there's for 3 boxes, each with 2 inputs and 2 outputs, there's some tripartite measurement which isn't of this form. Now, it is simpler in another way. So it isn't actually like a Bell measurement because it has product effects. But it's still, you couldn't do it with wires. So it is a non-trivial measurement. Okay, so that's just a little view of box world. So now I want to talk about entropies. So that was just sort of overview of general probability theories and a little focus in on box world. So what's our aim here? Our aim for this part of the talk is going to be to create an entropy which makes sense for any theory. So we want, instead of shifting and changing our entropy when we go from theory to theory, we want a concept of entropy that works across the whole framework. And because we want to sink in to the things that are already known, we're going to demand that this entropy reduces to the Shannon entropy in classical, if the theory we're actually describing is classical probability theory, and it reduces to the von Neumann entropy if the theory we're really talking about is quantum theory, and in other cases, it gives you something. So we'd be happy at the moment with just this reduction property, but the more properties we get, the better. So ideally, we'd want to carry over as many of the nice intuitive properties of the Shannon entropy as we possibly could to our new entropy, because, well, firstly, when we're thinking about entropic formulae, it's actually very helpful that a lot of the mathematical properties they have, which are quite complicated, have a really nice intuitive feel to them. And the other thing is that if we can keep a lot of these properties, then we're more likely to be able to lift proofs from the quantum case over to any general probabilistic theory. Now, unfortunately, this isn't as easy as you'd like, but I think this is at least the aim here. The more of these properties we can keep, the more our entropy will feel like a good intuitive thing in a general theory. Okay, so, of course, there's an infinite number of functions you could define, and I'm going to focus mainly on this particular definition. I'm going to talk about another definition later. But weirdly, of the 2 definitions I'm going to mention in this talk, all 3 of the papers that came out, I mentioned at the start, all had these 2 definitions in, independently. So they're obviously quite natural. I mean, I must point out that Kimura had another definition, which we didn't think of, which is very interesting, but I'm not going to probably have time to talk about that here. Okay, so this is the definition I want to focus on mainly, I'm sort of biased. I think this is the best one of the ones we've found because it has a lot of these properties. So this is quite a complicated formula, but what you're really doing here is you're saying, do the best. So the intuition here is entropy is about how hard it is to predict experimental results. So what how I'm going to define the entropy is I'm going to try and minimize the entropy of the outcomes for some measurement. So I'm going to try and find a measurement I can really predict the outcomes for. But there's a catch here, because there's always the unit measurement, which just always has the outcome yes or something, which is not so good. I mean, I can predict that with certainty. It's got low entropy, but it's not very helpful. So I have to restrict myself here. I'm going to force myself to only consider fine-grained measurements. So I have to do complicated measurements, and then I try and find one that's got as least uncertainty as possible. And so what this is trying to tell us, you don't need to worry about this being an infimum and not a minimum, but this is a bit safer. And then this is just saying that once you just essentially minimize over your set of fine-grained measurements, the classical entropy of the measurement outcomes. So this is just a nice shorthand notation for the Shannon entropy of the measurement results, basically. Okay, so this is... it sort of has at least some intuitive feel to it. It's very operational. What you're doing is you're just saying, I'll do any measurement I can and try and be as uncertain as I can about the outcomes. And, of course, the reason why this is, goes any distance at all is because this does reduce to the von Neumann and Shannon entropy in the appropriate theories. So, in particular, in classical probability theory, the only fine-grained measurement is just the measurement onto all the state space, so that's easy. And in quantum theory, it's not completely trivial to prove this, but it is true that the best thing you can do is measure in the eigenbasis of rho. That's the measurement which has the least entropy of the outcomes that's fine-grained. So you have to do something that only contains rank 1 PAVM elements, and you want to minimise your entropy. And the best thing to do is measure in the eigenbasis. And then, of course, it is equal to the von Neumann entropy. But, you know, you might have thought, well, maybe some crazy PAVM with lots of outcomes might do better, but it doesn't. Okay, so that was the sort of starting point. If we didn't have that property, we'd go back to the drawing board and pick another definition. So what other things do we get with this entropy? Well, it's positive at least because it's some function of the Shannon entropy, which is positive. It's at least a sense in which it's finite. So remember that, well, so we're only considering here measurements with finite sets of outcomes. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but we're not going to get into the confusion of continuous outcome sets here. So every measurement has some finite set of outcomes. And we know there's at least one fine-grained measurement. So and that has some finite set of outcomes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to define the size of a system by the minimal number of outcomes of some fine-grained measurement. Now, in quantum theory, the minimal outcome fine-grained measurements are projections onto the Hilbert space, so this would be the normal dimension. But this is a general concept that applies even if we've got restricted measurement sets or whatever. I mean, so absolutely, in these frameworks, we could be in the case where there are just no definite outcomes for any of them. We might have ruled out all the measurements which give definite outcomes. And so we've got no guarantee that there are any distinguishable states. So something like finding a maximal set of distinguishable states may be impossible because there may be no distinguishable states at all given the allowed measurements. But we still have this concept of size, which is good. And at least in unrestricted quantum theory, it's the same as the dimension. Okay. What else do we get? Well, we very easily get concavity, which is a very nice entropic property, very intuitive. The entropy of a mixture is more than the mixture of the entropies. Things get worse when you mix things, which is what you'd expect. The easy way to see that is, you can be more general, but suppose here that these infimums are all attained. You know, this entropy corresponds to some fine-grained measurement on the mixed state. But then you can use the concavity of the Shannon entropy to express that in terms of this measurement on the S1 and S2. So this just uses the concavity of the Shannon entropy. And then you know that whatever this, because E is fine-grained, this thing must be bigger than the minimal entropy of a fine-grained measurement, which is HS1. So it just very nicely gives you this. Okay, so these are really nice properties, and then there's a couple of other properties which hold with very weak assumptions. So if we make the quite reasonable assumption that the product of two fine-grained measurements is fine-grained, then we also get subadditivity, which is nice. And this is very natural, but, you know, in principle, we could have theories where there's some, for a joint system, there's some resolution of this fine-grained measurement in terms of, maybe entangled states that isn't possible locally. So it's a slight extra assumption, but certainly it's obeyed in all the theories we've mentioned. It's obeyed in Boxworld as well, as classical and quantum. And then if you limit, if it doesn't matter, if you don't have to consider arbitrarily large measurement outcome sets to get the optimal entropy. So if you can restrict some bounded number of outcomes without changing anything, then the whole thing is continuous. There's this slight pathological case where there may be a sort of infinite hierarchy of measurements with more and more outcomes which are somehow approaching your optimal entropy. And then you might be in trouble. We have a nicer kind of numerical bound on this distance, but it's a bit complicated to just put in here. So it is pretty smooth, as long as you're in a sort of not completely pathological case. Okay, and then, so these are all things which I think are very weak assumptions. So these things are pretty much in. And then there's something which is which we'd love, but we really have to assume something quite strong to get. So I take this with a pinch of salt, but it is a nice result. But I'm not going to go through it in great detail here. So obviously, the thing which we most connect with entropy is compression rates. And the thing is that with just the assumptions we have so far, we certainly can't prove that this entropy is anything like a compression rate. But if we make a couple of other quite strong assumptions, we can prove that. So what we need to end up assuming is that we have some kind of compression protocol, and during this protocol, we need to assume that all the measurements we're doing have some dynamical properties. So far, measurements are sort of one shot. You do a measurement, and then the system, we don't talk about what happens afterwards. But to talk about compression, you need to talk about what happens to the system afterwards. And so we assume that all the measurements that kind of come up in this approach have a sort of a bit like projectors. So in particular, they're repeatable, and if the measurement result's almost certain, then they don't change the state too much. So this is true of projectors. If you act on a projector and you're mostly in the support of that projector, the state doesn't get changed too much. But for arbitrary theories, and arbitrary sort of dynamical implementations of these measurements, all bets are off on these things. So these are quite strong assumptions, and there's another couple of technical assumptions, and then we can prove something that looks like a Schumacher compression rate, but we can only prove achievability rather than optimality. And the sense of compression, it involves the dimensions that we mentioned earlier. So these kind of effective sizes based on what measurements you can actually do. So, I mean, it is a sort of natural concept with restrictive measurements that this is a good notion of size and that it is the appropriate notion of compression, but it's a fair distance from like a complete, totally compelling, this is compression result. But it's still, you know, it's along the right path. So if you're interested in this, then I'd recommend looking at the paper, but I feel it's positive, you know, we can prove anything, but I'd say that the assumptions we're making here are quite strong. So, and it's not completely clear what theories they'll be obeyed by. So, but they're pretty natural. I mean, the idea is to sort of project onto a typical subspace in a sort of general setting, and these are the sort of things you need. Okay, so that's all the properties of this entropy, but we can. We could define other entropic quantities as well, and we can start to talk about them. So we can always define them analogously to the quantum quantities or the classical ones. But these don't have quite as nice properties as their analogs in quantum theory. Okay, so there's another kind of obvious choice of entropy, which is the decomposition entropy, where you minimize the entropy of mixtures of pure states. So you say, I've got some mixed state, I know I can decompose it to pure states, I'm going to call the entropy the Shannon entropy of the mixing probabilities. This might have been what you'd have come up with, and we indeed all these three papers did come up with this, essentially. But it turns out this is not as well behaved. So in box world, it's not concave or subadditive. So it's obviously not in general. Of course, it does reduce to the von Neumann and Shannon entropy in quantum theory and classical theory. But it also has some other counterintuitive properties as well. So, I mean, this is already makes it sort of worse than the previous one. But, for instance, if you had a maximally random box in box world, it has entropy 1 under this measure. But if you have two maximally random independent boxes, they still have entropy 1 because they're equal to a mixture of two PR, a PR and anti-PR box. And because it's a mixture of just two states, it's entropy 1. But somehow you had two independent entropy 1 things and had entropy 1 totally, which is going to lead to some confusion. But, I mean, I just say that having looked at this entropy, it just doesn't seem as nice as the kind of problems we're interested in. It doesn't have as many problems. Okay, so I'm going to talk now a bit about information causality. So this was really a main motivation for these entropies, because the proof is entropic for information causality. So to sort of understand better how the proof fails for box world, it was useful to have these entropies. So this is information causality, which you've probably seen before by now. So Alice gets some bit string, and Bob is asked for one of those bits. And then she gets to send m bits to Bob. Then Bob is asked for one of Alice's bits, and he has to make his best guess. And the figure of merit here is this sum of the informations between Bob's guess and the actual truth, given all the questions, and that this is bounded by m. So this is quite a complicated figure of merit, and it should be noted that if you just look at the probability of success in this game, then quantum can do better than classical. So it's not, it's just not true that quantum is not better than classical for this game. But it is true if you look at this particular figure of merit, which is quite a complicated entropic one. Having said that, we're in the mood of liking entropies at the moment, so we'll see what we can say about this. So in particular, this is violated in box world, and even in the case where n is 2 and m is 1, you get that the sum of entropies is 2 because the box is one PR box, and the right protocol lets Bob perfectly get the bit right every time, but you only send one bit of communication. So they definitely violate the inequality. But it's interesting to go through the proof and see where it breaks, because now we have a notion of mutual information for arbitrary theories, including Boxworld. We can see where the proof goes wrong, and maybe I won't worry too much about this, because I'm running a bit short of time, but it goes wrong, interestingly, at a point where the state is separable. So it's not non-locality which is causing it to go wrong. So this is a separable box world state where these green things are supposed to be classical bits, and this is part of a PL box that's been left after some operation. And in the proof, once you've got to this point, you use a data processing inequality to say that when you sort of forget, throw away X1, the mutual information goes down, and this isn't true in box world. So it means really that our intuition that the mutual information, that somehow this corresponds to forgetting, that the mutual information is somehow capturing our information, and that throwing away is somehow forgetting, something's gone wrong with that intuition here, because this is, when you have more stuff, you have less information. So this is not capturing the notion of information well, and it corresponds to a violation of strong subadditivity for our entropy. So this entropy we've been talking about in box world doesn't have strong subadditivity. Okay, so in general, so one of the nice things about this information causality paper is that it holds with just a few assumptions about the mutual information, the properties of the mutual information in your theory. So in fact, they give three properties. They say in the original paper, if you can define the mutual information with three properties, then this information causality is hold. But one slight insight is that actually this is a bit simpler even if you just look directly at entropies rather than mutual informations. So information causality will hold for any theory in which there is an entropy, which can be any function that satisfies these two properties. So if the system it acts on is a classical system, it better give you back the Shannon entropy. And then it only has to obey one other thing, which is just data processing in entropic form. So this inequality, which says that if I have a joint system and I do a transformation on A, then the change in entropy of the joint thing is more than the change in entropy of A. And this is something that I hadn't actually seen before, but if you expand it all out, it's equivalent to this statement about the mutual informations, which is much more recognizably data processing. But the advantage of this perspective is that entropies are simpler functions than mutual informations in the first place, because they only contain one object. And you only need really one a sort of reduction assumption and one non-trivial assumption, and you get information processing. So for me, this sort of suggests that I tend to see information causality as more of a consequence of the fact that there is a really good entropy in quantum theory. So the reason that mutual information holds in information causality holds in quantum theory is because it has this really well-behaved entropy with lots of nice properties, including this one. But in general theories, they don't have such good entropies, and therefore it sort of doesn't hold. And sort of motivation here might be to look at other... if the argument is that quantum theory has all these nice properties for the entropies and classical theory doesn't, then by looking at other protocols which are characterized by informations, there might well be other interesting ones which the proof will go over for quantum theory but not for general theories. And so you might be able to get other things like information causality, which maybe aren't about non-locality but about some other information processing protocol. And assuming you can state the whole thing in terms of entropies and the proof only involving entropies in the quantum case, then the chances are it won't hold in other theories. Okay, and then I just want to turn in the last sort of 2 or 3 minutes to a brief look at... So it seems like, to me, one of the things I find very surprising is that entropies are these weird non-linear functions, and yet they've been used to generate parts of the polytope of quantum... the set of quantum correlations, and that struck me as very odd because I just find it hard to believe that these entropic functions are really kind of touching the polytope somehow. But it turns out that you can see this in terms of a non-local gain. So in particular, if you have... So information causality, in the proof of the rederivation of Cyrilson's bound, you actually go through thinking about information causality as a non-local gain. So now Alice guesses a bit A and Bob guesses a bit B, and their sum has got to equal Alice's correct bit. And in the proof, you actually get rid of the entropies and you replace them with a quadratic function of the probabilities. So if I define the bias in a gate, the bias when Bob's asked the question why by 2py minus 1, so it's a normal bias where py is the probability of success, then in these gains you get... So in the proof of information causality, you end up with a step which says that for this non-local gain, there's a sum of squares bound on the biases of how well they can do in the game when Bob's asked question why of this form. And then the proof continues. But this leads one to believe, you know, to ask, well, can I just derive these bounds directly from quantum theory? And it's a very elegant proof, which we haven't got time to go through. But the answer is yes. So with, I mean, this is essentially the proof, and you can prove that for information causality non-local game, the sum of the biases squared is bounded by 1, which means that quantum is no better than classical. And yet, this can be n for general box world. And this quadratic bound is quite a nice thing in its own right. It's tighter than the bound you can get on the probability of success because you can use it to derive the probability of success. It really says, you know, if you try and do really well on even one outcome, the rest are going to be rubbish. And we can even extend this result to from the information causality game to the inner product game. So this same bound applies to the inner product game, where Bob gets asked any question or any subset of questions, and Alice gets random bits, and they have to give the inner product, modulo 2. And so this is a nice simple proof of quite a strong bound, and it actually contains the normal Cyrilson bound and the quadratic form of the Cyrilson bound, and it contains the information causality result. And so I think this is in itself a quite interesting bound, which is sort of inspired by entropies, but actually doesn't contain them. So. And that's all I wanted to say. So sorry, I haven't got so much time for questions, but just a few exciting kind of ideas. So the key concept is that quantum theory is really rare and special because it has an entropy with loads of great properties. And most theories don't have an entropy with so many properties, so it's potentially something that could feed into axiomatizations that we want a good entropy. We could look for other informational principles where the proofs would lift to quantum theory but not lift to other theories. We could ask, is there a connection to statistical physics? This is something that someone mentioned earlier today. And then maybe these quadratic bounds are useful anyway, just outside of entropic argument, because they're quite tight bounds and they're quite easy to prove. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
So thanks a lot, Tony, for this very clear talk. We have time for a few questions.
First of all, I just wanted to make a quick comment. You were very generous at giving credit to the multiple authors who worked on this stuff, but there was somebody who worked on it in the 1970s, as usual, a guy called Hein. But I have a couple of questions concerning statistical physics. So do you have any conjecture on what the thermodynamic entropy might be for a general theory? And related to that, do you think requiring that thermodynamics works as we know it would be a good axiom for quantum theory?
So I think it would be a good axiom. I mean, so my hunch is that actually it wouldn't be this measurement entropy. It would be the decomposition entropy or something like it. Because I just think that that's closer to what statistical physics is doing, looking at mixtures of states and ignorance over states. So if I had to guess, I'd go veer towards the not this nice entropy, but one that was a bit less nice. But it could be something in the middle. So there is this nice entropy which contain. So the entropy which Jen Kamira, I hope I got that right, invented, it combines both states and measurements. So it's symmetric, but it's more complicated. So you do the sort of maximum over both states, over both decompositions and measurement, any measurement of the sort of mutual information between the preparation and the result. So it's a bit more complicated, but it has a symmetry which is appealing. So I don't know whether that might have some better properties. And is thermodynamics a good thing to want? I mean, I like it because I think it's very connected to reversibility, which I think is one of the big important things. So I think connecting this to reversibility and to sort of what you mean by sort of simple initial states, I don't know. I mean, so I've also done a lot of other work on statistical physics where the key is that entanglement is somehow responsible for equilibration. So I don't know how that would feed into all this work. I mean, it's a very open question as far as I'm concerned, but I think it's an interesting, there's lots of interesting sub-questions. So.
Hi. So just a few sort of related comments, and I wonder what your response is. So in terms of using some idea concerning entropy as an axiom, one thing that worries me is something you touched on, which is that it's a logarithmic function of probabilities, and yet quantum theory doesn't have any sort of logarithms in its statements.
Exactly,
what worried me when I thought. It's kind of surprising that information causality gets, as you said, makes any progress at all on this.
And indeed it does it by dropping entropies and replacing them by quadratics at some point.
So
quadratics obviously feel very quantum, so that's
that feels a lot better. The pure states are defined by, as Chris Fuchs pointed out in his talk, are defined by a quadratic and a cubic equation. Really you'd think you want those rather than logarithmic equations. It'd be interesting if one could find some axiomatic reason for, but the quadratic equation you can get from any number of different places, but the cubic equation is difficult. But then the other point I wanted to make was, one sort of axiom that people have talked about is the axiom that you can write any general state as a linear combination of some set of distinguishable states.
Right.
And that's true in quantum theory. It seems that fact makes it possible, at least that fact certainly helps the fact that you have an entropy in quantum theory, maybe what it makes it possible. And I wonder if you thought about that at all.
So I suppose one of the aims here was to not, was to sort of include the case of fuzzy world where, which I think is really interesting, where there just are no distinguishable states. So when, a problem with that, so a lot of these axioms that sort of have these distinguishable states in them, it worries me because I can't sort of in principle see why anything should be distinguishable imperfectly. But I think part of it might be because of embedding classical variables. So you certainly sort of do want your state to somehow have some representation of classical variables and manipulations. And of course, they give you some spaces where it's distinguishable. So I wonder whether embedding, the necessity to embed classical variables might be quite a useful axiom somehow, that there's something in your theory. And then that would lead on to there being some distinguishable things, which then would maybe force your entropy to have better properties, or I don't know. But on the face of it, all these sort of maximal distinguishable things, I can think of lots of theories that just don't have that property. And I think that you still would ask questions about compression and information processing and those theories. So I think it can't be the whole story to just have those, maybe. I think I've maybe discuss more later.
But. Tony, your entropy is sort of single shot.
Yeah.
Entropy. However, there are many cases that are known whether it's much better to do some sort of block processing. For example, suppose that you would like a measurement that is better of identifying a state, suppose fidelity or something like that. And in that case, if you would like to make a single-shot measurement, then the best measurement for identifying the state will not have minimal output entropy. But if you process in blocks, it will have.
So I suppose I suppose I don't actually demand single-shot measurements. So any procedure you might care to do involving measuring and then doing some dynamics and then doing another measurement, that in this formalism, that would just that whole process would be represented by a measurement. Well, again, but I mean, any joint measurement would also be. I see what you mean. So you're saying to define the entropy of a single state, perhaps you should look asymptotically at many copies of it, and do some. But isn't this just the entropy of multiple systems? I don't. Maybe I'm not quite seeing the point here. Certainly, you're allowed to have multiple systems and do them all some collective measurement. Everything would apply to that.
Okay, so let's leave it there, and thank Tony again.